This is Vermont Edition. I'm Lydia Brown, in for Jane Lindholm.
And I'm Angela Evansy, the host and creator of Brave Little State. It's become a kind of tradition for our people-powered journalism show. Every summer, we hit the pavement, or dirt, in an effort to answer your questions about Vermont's most unusual road names.
Like right here's about the place, it drops off really quickly.
But not every effort is successful.
I don't really know anything about where I come from.
As usual, we'll be referencing the authoritative book Vermont Place Names by Esther Monroe Swift. By the way, everyone should keep an eye out for this book at yard sales and the like, because it is out of print and very expensive used. If you happen to have a spare copy lying around, get in touch. We have support from the VPR Innovation Fund. Welcome. If you're a regular listener, you know our show runs public voting rounds to determine which listener question we take on. Normally, we have three finalists and one winner. But for this show, since we get so many road name questions, we did something different. 10 finalists and 4 winners. Our first answer turned out to be quite spooky.
Our first question comes from Peter Langella, who wanted to know the true origin of Devil's Washbowl, a single-lane dirt road connecting the towns of Moortown and Northfield.
And the reason I said true origin is because there's so many myths, you know, kind of surrounding what this road is.
A single winding road is the only way in and the only way out. Locals call it the Devil's Washbowl.
Stories about what's happened there.
They came running back to the school, one of them in tears and scared stiff. They were really shook up. Something charged at them down over the bank of the sand pit. They named it the Pigman.
The Pigman.
Pigman.
Pigman. Head of a hog. Claws for hands. Human feet. Where the man ends and the pig begins is anybody's guess.
So that's when the manhunt started.
And so that's kind of all part of it. Like, everyone has these little stories, but I really wanted to see if your program could get to the true root of all of that.
It's nearly impossible to tell the story of Devil's Washbowl without also telling the story of a legendary creature said to roam the woods here, the Pigman.
Let's move out of the road here a bit.
Few speak about the Pigman with more authority than Jeff Hatch. Jeff's from this area, and per his request, we meet at a culvert along Devil's Washbowl. It's one of the few pull-offs along this road, and it's quiet here, almost otherworldly.
I used to bring my grandsons up here and at night, and we'd stop right here.
Here, beneath a canopy of deciduous trees, it's daytime, but jagged shadows cast a sea of darkness around us. It's the kind of atmosphere that beckons a spine-chilling story, and Jeff has one to tell. It begins something like this.
As 17, 18-year-old boys...
It was the early 1970s, and Northfield High School was hosting a dance.
When we would have a dance, we would hide our beer down in the sand pit behind the cemetery by the school. One night we were all at the dance, and a couple of the fellas headed to the sand pit. And these were normal guys. These weren't little kids that were afraid of things. They came running back to the school. One of them in tears and scared stiff. They were really shook up.
According to Jeff, his classmates had had a run-in with some sort of creature.
They said it was all white, the size of a person, running on 2 feet. Covered in white hair. They named it the Pigman because it had the face of a pig and the body of a person.
You might recall our question asker Peter was curious about the true origin of the stories tied to Devil's Washbowl. Well, if you continue along this road in the direction of Northfield, you'll eventually come across a seemingly important clue.
There used to be a pig farm.
This place is storied among locals, and what better setting for a pigman hunt than a pig farm?
So we would come up here at night and go to the pig farm, and there was 600-pound pigs in the buildings. In the dark, there was no power. But we would go in there looking.
Before long, others began reporting encounters with the pig man.
Someone lived up on Turkey Hill, which is the other side of town, and they heard something in their trash cans. So they flipped on the light to see. And there was a figure at the end of their driveway, all white, covered in hair, rummaging in the trash can. So they yelled at it, and it turned and looked at them, and it had the face of a pig and claws, and it made a horrendous noise and ran off.
Could you potentially make the noise?
I don't think I could potentially make the noise. It was a snarl, kind of a growl, high-pitched.
Back at Devil's Washbowl, Jeff says the creature began targeting young romantics.
So one night, there was a couple up here, and something jumped on their car. Clawed the sides of their sides of their car all up. Scratched it all up. Broke one of the mirrors off.
Did you see the car?
I did see the car. And something obviously had happened. There was something that had come after them. And that happened 4 or 5 times during the course of the next summer.
If you look at the broader context of when, what was happening in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, is that you have a time of really big social upheaval around the country.
This is Andrew Liptak. He grew up in Moortown, just a short drive from Devil's Washbowl. He's a writer, journalist, and sci-fi fanatic, and he's given a lot of thought to the Pigman and the appeal of this local legend.
You have, UFO sightings. You have Bigfoot. There's a lot of, social anxiety, and I think people are sort of look for, scary things that are sort of intangible to sort of latch onto that you can't quite explain away.
Some even connect this area to the devil itself, which takes us back to our question asker and the true origin of Devil's Washbowl. Again, here's Peter.
My wife's grandfather, he would tell stories about, hearing that that's where, the devil washed his dishes down there in the washbowl where kind of the road bends and the brook comes through.
An alternate version has it that it's where the devil would go to wash his feet.
Go there to wash something.
Kay Schluters lived in Northfield since the mid-1980s. She spent more than a decade as curator for the Northfield Historical Society. And after hearing Peter's question, Kay began her own investigation into the origin of the name Devil's Washbowl, which led her, perhaps not too surprisingly, to Esther Swift's Vermont place names. While there's no direct reference to Devil's Washbowl in this book, Esther does cite other locations with devil in the name.
They all have to do with an area of land or a hill or something that's difficult. And so people associate that sometimes with devil.
An inhospitable landscape.
And yeah, right here's about the place, is it drops off really quickly.
Andrew Liptak takes me for a distanced walk back to the place where I met Jeff Hatch, the culvert. It's located in a basin said to be the washbowl, and the temperature immediately drops here.
So you've got the trees coming up above you, and they arch over the road, and they're old. You can see they're big, and they've been here for a long time. They're just dark, and, right now it's midday, but October, November, the sun sets really fast over the mountain. The light will just vanish. That's when, the idea of ghosts and monsters isn't quite so implausible.
That piece was produced by Lydia Brown. Coming up, a circuitous investigation into Lost Nation Road. But first,
We were just driving around with our young daughter trying to help her get some sleep. And we were driving from Grafton to Chester, and we noticed a road called Popple Dungeon Road.
This is question asker Patrick Spurlock.
I grew up in the 80s, and there was a cartoon show and a corresponding stuffed animal line from Hasbro called Popples.
Mom, here come the Popples for your child.
Popples are pals that pop out of pockets. Popples are pals that pop out of pockets.
And obviously there was also a separate thing for older kids called Dungeons and Dragons.
Barbarian, magician, thief, Cavalier and Acrobat.
So I see a road called Popple Dungeon Road, and the mental imagery is just crazy. So I'm like, where did this name come from?
So is there any connection between Popples and the Popple Dungeon Roads in Vermont?
Would that it were so. I wish, somehow.
Lucky for us, the answer to Patrick's question was already out there, thanks to this gentleman, Ethan DeSeif.
My research suggests that there is no connection.
Ethan lives in California now. He's a lecturer in communications and media studies at Sonoma State University. But he used to work for 7 Days. And in 2014, he wrote this piece.
WTF, why are streets in two Vermont towns named Popple Dungeon Road?
Those two towns are Chester and Charlotte, which are in totally different parts of the state. I want to note that our question asker, Patrick, knew that some sort of answer to his question existed, but he told me that he purposefully avoided it because he wanted BLS to answer it, which, Patrick, that is such a compliment. Thank you. But Ethan DeSeif really does get all the credit for this one.
In this context, Popple is a term, it's an old New England term, not used much anymore, as far as I know, that can refer to any number of trees. One would suspect that it has a close relationship with a poplar tree, and it can often, and often does, refer to poplar trees, but it's not specific to poplar.
So kind of a vernacular nickname, almost, for just trees.
As far as I can tell, and that was by consulting the Dictionary of American Regional English.
Okay, so that's Popple. What about dungeon? What's the connection there?
Yeah, so the dungeon part was the weirdest part. And that was the part that I remember being most puzzled by. But then I found this book called The Source, Popple Dungeon, Vermont, The Settlement, Farms, and Genealogy of a Small Community in Vermont. And I thought, well, that book was tailor-made for this question.
An entire book about Popple Dungeon. Sometimes you just get lucky.
And so basically there was a stretch of road in Chester that locals referred to as the dungeon because there were a bunch of tree branches that hung over the road so that it apparently cast dark shade. It was a shadowy stretch of road. And so by association with a dungeon being a dark place, that road was the Popple Dungeon Road.
How did Charlotte pick up this eccentric name? Ethan heard this story from a Charlotte resident named Ed Amidon.
I remember him telling me that originally people moved into a street. It was unnamed in Charlotte. And the family who lived there, according to Ed Amidon, had a mischievous son, I think is how he put it, who stole the road sign from the Chester Popple Dungeon Road and put it on the street sign, or, you know, nailed it to a tree or something like that, and declared this new street in Charlotte also to be named Popple Dungeon Road. Why? I don't know if we'll ever know.
Whatever the reason, the name stuck. And eventually, it got recorded as the official name of the road after a 1993 statute that required every road in Vermont to have a name for E911 response.
That's just what locals got to calling it. And so when it was time to declare a name, there was one name that was ready. And so there we go, Popple Dungeon Road. What else are we going to call it?
What else, indeed? This is Brave Little State's third annual brief history of Vermont road names. When we come back, a BLS reporter is humbled by a seemingly straightforward question. That's right after this.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Lydia Brown.
And I'm Angela Evansy, host of Brave Little State. Today on the program, you asked, BLS answered, or at least did its best to answer your questions about Vermont's most bizarre, mysterious road names.
Before the break, we heard about Devil's Washbowl and Popple Dungeon Road. Now we move on to another question, this one reported by VPR's Nina Keck. And listeners, when you voted for this question, I don't think you quite knew what Nina would be in for.
Can you hear me? Am I still here?
I can hear you, Ellen, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
This is Ellen Reed of St. Albans. She's mostly retired now, but she used to spend a lot of time driving for work.
Traveling in rural Vermont, I've come across roads that are named Lost Nation Road. I wonder, what does the name Lost Nation refer to? more than one town has them. I've found them in Essex. I found them in Fairfield, Bakersfield, Enosburg, and they seem to be remotely located.
Ellen's right. According to the state's 911 emergency mapping system, there are five separate Lost Nation roads that cross eight different towns, and all are in northern Vermont. Ellen says the name has always made her wonder.
Oh, well, I think it conjures up images of mystical things. I don't know, was it the 12th tribe of Israel, or was it Indians, or a settlement that didn't make it? I don't know.
In Vermont, if you're thirsty, you can pour yourself a Lost Nation beer. Drama or comedy are on tap at the Lost Nation Theater in Montpelier, where they would be if we weren't in the midst of a pandemic. Firepower, that's available at Lost Nation Guns and Ammo in Swanton. But the stories behind this phrase, that, dear listeners, became a bit of a goose chase. According to Esther Swift's book of Vermont place names, the Lost Nation Road in East Fairfield was probably a nickname, since it was an area far from the more settled section of town. Swift's entry on the Lost Nation Road in Essex was equally bland. Seems someone got lost in that area, and when he was found, he announced he'd been at Lost Nation. Not much to go on.
Town of Bakersfield, this is Tammy.
Hi, Tammy. This is Nina Keck.
To try to answer this question, I made a lot of calls. Town clerks, librarians, longtime residents, and historical society members.
That doesn't mean I know all this stuff. I've only lived here a little over 20 years.
I don't really know anything about where I come from.
Okay, so first of all, what's your name again?
It's Nina.
Now that I know that it's not a prank call.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. You can Google me now.
I don't know of anybody around now that would even know how the hell he got his name.
Gary Montague, that's his sister.
Okay, N-I-N-A.
Correct.
No, not really. Not the history of it. I just know the name of it. I've only lived here since 1987.
Just.
Yeah.
Despite all those phone calls.
Well, thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
All right, good luck.
I struck out. I did not find any solid answers or fleshed out theories on the Lost Nation roads in Bakersfield, Berkshire, or East Haven, which Craftsbury resident Dave Link nicely rubbed in.
So you still got a mystery.
But Dave said we're not the only ones curious about the name. He said the Craftsbury Historical Society, which he's a member of, discussed this very topic back in 2015 during one of their meetings.
Lost Nation Road. Yeah. Lost Nation Road. This one puzzled me.
Well,
yeah. When did they name it and by whom? That's the big, those are the two big
questions. Well, there was a hippie colony.
Yeah. One gentleman remembers a hippie colony in North Walcott that called themselves Lost Nation Farm. They'd previously lived in Craftsbury. Maybe they named the road, he wondered. Others weren't sure. I can't see the moderator at this meeting, but I imagine he's shrugging his shoulders at this point as he looks around the room and hears no clear consensus.
Well, there's a history's mystery.
Another of history's mysteries, he declares, and moves on to the next quirky road name. Russ Spring has a family business on the Lost Nation Road in Craftsbury. His parents founded the Craftsbury Outdoor Center back in the 1970s, and he's heard several theories about the road name.
The most interesting one was a story told by Earl Wilson, who was an old-timer, who many years ago actually plotted the route of the Bailey-Hazen Road as it went through Craftsbury.
Russ mentioned the Bailey-Hazen Trail, like I should know what it was, but I didn't, and it's worth explaining. I think some fife and drum music would help here. During the Revolutionary War, the Continental Army needed a shorter route to Canada to help in their siege of Quebec. So in 1776, George Washington ordered this new road to be cleared and built between what is now Newbury, Vermont, and St. John's, Quebec, near Montreal. Jacob Bailey and Moses Hazen were the key instigators of building it. So that's where that road name comes from. If only Lost Nation were as easily explained. Anyway, work on the Bailey-Hazen Road proceeded in fits and starts for several years during the Revolution until it was eventually abandoned. According to Earl Wilson's theory, that Revolutionary War trail may help explain the Lost Nation Road in Craftsbury.
When they were kind of clearing that trail, they came across a pre-existing trail. And they decided, well, this must we're going to call this the Lost Nation Road after the Lost Nation of Israel that must have made it. But in fact, Earl thought it was more likely a trail that was made by Native Americans along the side of the lake. And it just intersected the route of the Bailey Hazen Road. That was how he told the story.
This Native American connection comes up a lot, and not just in Vermont. There are actually Lost Nation roads all over the country. I asked Rich Holshue about this.
I am a resident of Wantastagak, better known as Brattleboro, Vermont. I serve as a spokesperson for the Elnu Abenaki tribe here in southern Vermont.
Rich is a researcher of local indigenous culture. He doesn't know of any corresponding Abenaki references in the Vermont towns with Lost Nation roads. He thinks the name reflects a broader story of the erasure and displacement of Native people, a story that he says has been cloaked in mystery and fantasy.
Americans love to romanticize Native heritage. We name our athletic teams, we name our butter after them, we... All different things. It becomes a romantic thing, and it's got very little to do with truth in that the building of this country is founded upon displacing all of that and exploiting it.
Rich says a road sign with the name Lost Nation helps sustain a stereotype that Native American communities are gone. That, of course, is false.
What they don't realize is that the Native person might be standing right next to them and looks exactly like them. And the reason that they don't see that is because they weren't taught that. They're ignorant of that. And if one does not recognize or know about something, you don't care about it.
Native people are still here, says Rich. They haven't vanished. But what happened to them, the occupation, the colonization, the reality of that, is hard to face.
And so it's a lot easier to have lost nations.
Tim German has been doing his own sleuthing on the history of Lost Nation Road, where he lives in Essex. Here, he thinks the name recalls a different kind of community.
Kind of a nasty day to go exploring.
Yeah, but I got some umbrellas, so we won't have to go far.
On a rainy Monday, Tim drives me to northwest Essex, a part of town historians refer to as the Lost Nation area.
There's not much you can see on it now. It's just a dirt road in the country.
Tim's been researching early 19th century homesteads in this area.
But all of this road, and especially out here, the names. Wood, that's an Irish name. Shanley is an Irish name. And all of these people I found in the census, they were all born in Ireland.
We get out of his car to hike in nearby Indian Brook Park, which backs up on the Lost Nation Road.
You'll see how rocky and hard scrabble it is. It's right here. This is the, doesn't look like much, but that's a man-made, that was a cellar hole right there. And this was one of the Day families.
Using historical records, Tim's been able to identify a large number of homesteads. Some, like this one, are now nothing more than echoes. Rocky holes covered with sticks and brambles hidden alongside the trail.
And then you come to find out that there's at least 30 families, and then as time goes on, more than that, you know, moving in, and they're very Irish, and they're in the poorest part of town. And as you start to think about it, if you hike here in the fall or the winter, and you start, oh my God, winter here before any amenities. But this was a difficult, difficult life. So I just started to think, Lost Nation. Lost Nation is their homeland.
There's something very poetic about the name Lost Nation. Almost sad, a little mythic.
It is very poetic, yeah. It is sad. It's evocative of something that was there before. You know, there were people living here, and there was a community here. And then over time, it just became too hard.
That piece was produced by Nina Keck. For our last question.
To me, this is coming into the notch proper because we don't have any center lines.
I'm sitting in the back seat of Barbara Bayraw's Subaru, wearing a mask, getting a tour of Route 108, a.k.a. Mountain Road.
Can you see through those trees? There's one of the more recent landslides.
This steep and narrow road winds through the area that Misha Torin asked us about.
My name is Misha Torin. I'm from Jericho, Vermont. How did Smuggler's Notch get its name, and what kind of legends and folklore still exist about treasure hunting in that area today?
Smuggler's Notch. Not exactly a road name, but, you know.
Like, I know a little bit about the history. I know that the name of Smuggler's Notch comes from the trade embargoes with Great Britain and Canada, and I know that there was some smuggling that happened during Prohibition. But I've also heard that there's these tales of, like, treasure that has been hidden in the caves there and in the rock walls and different things like that. And I'm curious what kind of like treasure hunter type things there are there.
What is the treasure? What is the treasure? The treasure of Smuggler's Notch.
According to this song by Rockin' Ron the Friendly Pirate, the treasure is honey from a honeybee. A bit tangential, but it's been in my head ever since I found it on YouTube. So I thought I'd pass it on.
They hide it in a cave, and it's really, really, really in there.
Billy Bob!
What is the treasure? What
As for the origin of the name, perhaps you've heard the history that Misha mentions, that the notch was used for smuggling goods and cattle around the War of 1812, and then later booze during Prohibition, that smugglers used the rocky pass for hiding out or stashing contraband. It's compelling.
And we'll pull in, and I'll show you the caves.
Perfect.
And we'll start the myth conversation.
The myth busting?
My tour guide, Barbara Bayraw, happens to be the president of the Stowe Historical Society. When we get to the top of the notch, we stand by some stone outcroppings. And she tells me that the stories of smuggling here, particularly in the 1800s, seem to be just that. Stories.
I don't need total written documentation, but I need more than just a comment or two. And I've read a lot of the local town meetings, letters, and I can't put it together. I mean, if it's true, I'd love somebody to put it under my nose. I really would, because then I wouldn't have to go looking anymore.
Barbara doesn't put much stock in another genre of stories, which is that people fleeing slavery use the notch to move north.
Lots of other ways to go. Just going up and down the major highways like Route 7 or 100.
The first road through the notch for automobiles was surveyed in 1917. For this reason, Barbara thinks the stories of prohibition smuggling during the 20s and 30s are more plausible.
But I don't believe that it was part of the big movement that has been written about coming across the border and going down into Albany or going over into the Boston area. It comes back to that same question.
That same question being, why would you take the path of most resistance? The Notch Road isn't easy going, even today. Plus, this area has been known as Smuggler's Notch since at least the late 1800s. Isn't that a little predictable?
Yeah, if you're smuggling booze during the Prohibition, probably the last place you want to go is where it's named Smuggler's Notch, because that's where the cops are going to be waiting.
Brian Lindner is another historian of this area.
In my opinion, as a historian, it's much more likely that there wasn't really any smuggling going on through Smuggler's Notch. This is probably where the smugglers that were active over in the Lake Champlain Valley came to hide, because this is a perfect hiding spot. But it's a terrible place to smuggle products back and forth through the notch itself.
Brian grew up in Stowe, right at the entrance to the notch. Until he was 10 years old, he literally lived in a ski lodge.
My dad was the forest ranger here, for the Mount Mansfield State Forest, and our apartment was in the north end of the Mount Mansfield Base Lodge, so that's where we lived.
Brian is retired now and calls himself an unofficial historian at Stowe Mountain Resort. He's full of stories about this area, but they're true stories, not legends. Stories of the Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC.
They constructed the first ski trails in Vermont.
And of this area's connection to World War II and the 10th Mountain Division, which waged battle on skis.
In World War II, Minnie Dole, who was a member of Mount Mansfield Ski Patrol, founded the National Ski Patrol. He convinced President Roosevelt to form the 10th Mountain Division in World War II. So you can trace the 10th Mountain Division roots right back to Stowe.
Brian even told me the story of a Bonnie and Clyde-style shootout that happened here in the Notch.
July 1931, a fellow deserted the army at Fort Ethan Allen, committed murder over in the Jeffersonville side of the Notch, and as he was driving through, people in Jeffersonville, Cambridge, called the Stowe side and said, set up a roadblock, there's a killer coming through Smuggler's Notch. Amazingly, they riddled the car with bullets and never hit him once.
No way.
Our question asker, Misha, asked about legends of treasure here in Smuggler's Notch. In my research, I found mostly general references to stashes of loot left behind by smugglers, which maybe there weren't so many of those. I also saw a few mentions of a Captain Slayton, a former 49er, who searched for gold in a local brook and either didn't find much or did, but pretended he didn't. Neither Brian Lindner nor Barbara Beira had any treasure stories to share. They say the true stories are just as good. But if you want to tell tales of smuggling and hiding out in the Notch, Barbara Beira doesn't mind.
No, we have to have myths and legends. I mean, that's what society is about. That's what oral history is about. And it's fun.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Lydia Brown.
And I'm Angela Evansy. You've been listening to Brave Little State's third annual Brief History of Vermont Road Names.
When we come back, a visit to the archive. We air highlights from Brave Little State's first two road name episodes, including one reporter's dive into the origin of Putney's High-Low Biddy Road. That's next. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Lydia Brown.
And I'm Angela Evansy, host of Brave Little State. Earlier, we aired the latest installment of our show's annual exploration of Vermont road names. Now, we thought we'd pay a visit to the archive and air a few listener questions from road name episodes past. Here's one from John in Arlington, who is curious about the origin of Mad Tom Road in East Dorset.
Hi there.
Hi, you must be Angela.
I am Angela, yes. Sylvia.
It's a question commonly asked at Mad Tom Orchard, a few miles out of town. Pick your own apples with a view.
I'm Sylvia Smith, and I live at Mad Tom Orchard.
I'm Tom Smith, and I also live at Mad Tom Orchard, and together Sylvia and I run that business.
Yes, Tom Smith of Mad Tom Orchard on Mad Tom Road.
Because my name is Tom, we do get a lot of questions in terms of, did they name the road after you and this type of thing.
It's a popular theory among the kindergartners from Northshire Day School. They come to pick apples in the fall.
They'll often come in and say, are you Mad Tom? And he'll say, yes, but I'm not mad today.
As charming as it is, this is not the origin of the name Mad Tom Road. This orchard was established in 1940, long before Tom and Sylvia Smith took over. And the road itself was named long before that. It first appears on the map in 1856.
Madam Swift, the expert of all roads, says Mad Tom derives its name from the tumbling rush it makes as it comes down out of the mountains.
Our road expert, Paul Gillis, says the Mad Tom Road is named for Mad Tom Brook, so-called, evidently, because of its mad, unpredictable waters. We'll get to the Tom part in a bit.
I did find an interesting article from the Manchester Journal of October 3rd, 1912, that said there is a hope that the old Notch Road, which was that Mad Tom Road, may be given up. Every flood that rushes down that narrow canyon washes out both road and bridges, about 3 miles of it. Several $1,000 was expended for bridges and road there this summer, only to be destroyed in the recent flood. This steep, narrow, hard, and dangerous road can be abandoned with little inconvenience to the public.
And so that was a piece that you found. What year was it from?
1912.
So I guess I'd be curious to know if that prediction, that very dire prediction in the piece that, you know, this road's just going to keep flooding and over, has that come to pass?
So the storm we had in April, the water was on both sides of this road.
Oh,
wow.
The road
was overtopped, and the whole road, really from here back to where it crosses, was underwater.
Just this past April?
Yes. Yeah, so the April 15th storm.
Rob Giotti is Dorset's town manager. It's a rainy morning, and he's driving me along Mad Tom Road in his Toyota Tacoma. This part here, that flooded in April, actually runs along a second waterway, the headwaters of the Otter Creek.
So
it's so small up here.
Yeah, it looks timid now.
Down a ways, Rob shows me where the Mad Tom Brook comes out of Mad Tom Notch and cuts close to the road.
We're going to go over a little bridge here, and the Mad Tom goes right underneath it. And you can kind of see the debris field there.
Oh, yeah. Can I roll down the road?
Yeah, go ahead.
In addition to the April flood, Rob says there was also damage to this road during Tropical Storm Irene in 2011, when the Mad Tom caused some washouts on Mad Tom.
And both of those events kind of ended up being FEMA disaster storms.
So this would explain the Mad, but what about the Tom?
Well, there is no one individual, Mad Tom. Mad Tom really is a cultural figure.
To answer that question, I hop on Skype and talk to this gentleman.
Do you want my full title and all the rest of it?
That'd be great.
Do you want my full? Okay, my name is Dr. Simon Cross, and I'm a senior lecturer in media and cultural studies at Nottingham Trent University in the UK.
And this is where the story gets super interesting, because Mad Tom isn't just a random phrase. It originated centuries ago in England.
Perhaps I'd better start with the idea of Bedlam. That might be the best way to begin.
Simon Cross says the full phrase is Mad Tom of Bedlam, and it all started in a place that came to be known as the Royal Bethlem Hospital.
It began life in and around the 11th century in England, and for hundreds of years, Bethlem was the only public institution housing the insane. It was a very small institution based in London, but at the same time it loomed large in the popular imagination. And in that sense, Bethlem becomes corrupted in popular language as Bedlam.
Bedlam, as in the word we all use for a chaotic situation. That's where that comes from.
And Tom, or the figure of Mad Tom, emerges sometime around the 15th or 16th, early 16th century, as somebody who has spent time in Bedlam / Bethlehem.
The stereotype takes hold in early modern England and sticks.
And appears, for instance, in Shakespeare's King Lear.
There were poems and ballads written about Mad Tom. Some are still sung today.
To find my Tom of Bedlam, 7,000 years I'll travel. Mad Maudlin goes on dirty toes to save her shoes from gravel.
So while that we sing Bonnie Boys, Bonnie Mad Boys, Bedlam Boys are Bonnie for. They all go bare and they live in the air and they want no drink nor money.
Simon Cross has written a fascinating article about all this called Bedlam in Mind, Seeing and Reading Historical Images of Madness. We've got a link up at our website. But he was surprised to hear that Mad Tom had made it all the way to Vermont.
It's got to be a rarity. It seems to me that you might be the only place in the world that has a Mad Tom Road or a Mad Tom River.
And there's our more well-known Mad River Valley as well. Obviously, mad is an antiquated term when we talk about mental health today, but Simon Cross says it's a quality to be celebrated.
You get the sense with your mad references in Vermont that there's something about the landscape, there's something about the interior of the region that lends itself to the idea that it is wild and unpredictable and fascinating and idiosyncratic, peculiar, but enjoyable even as well.
It seems to me that that description of the Vermont landscape is spot on. The next question from our archive comes from Michael Hudson in Putney. Michael wrote in, quote, "For the love of God, please tell me the origin of Putney's high-low Biddy Road." Independent producer Bianca Gaver took this one. Bianca spent last summer studying at the Breadloaf School of English in Ripton. So that's where her story starts.
This is a place where people think about words all day. So I'm excited to see if they have any thoughts about high-low Biddy. Everyone's noses aren't books right now.
Hello.
Hi. I'm doing a story about the history of Vermont road signs, and I got assigned High Low Biddy Road, and I'm just wondering, do you have any guesses about what that might mean, High Low Biddy?
I don't know why I think this, but I feel like it might have something to do with a cow.
My first thought was about like a dance, kind of like a ditty, but now that I'm thinking about it, it's kind of like Little Biddy. Yeah.
Like a little bit of a ditty.
Like a little bitty ditty.
Maybe it's a person?
Who is the person?
High-low Biddy Road.
Oh, like first name high-low, middle name Biddy, last name Road?
Yeah.
I walked across campus to see if there were any more clues here about high-low Biddy. I'm going to the adorable library. It's a white house filled with books. They happen to have the Vermont Road Name book. Vermont Place Names by Esther Swift. It didn't talk about High-Low Biddy Road, but it did talk about Biddy Knob in Rutland County. Oh, okay, okay, oh, okay. Biddy Knob is a peak more than 2,000 feet high. No one can explain the origin of its name. Biddy means a chicken or a hen. The word can also be a diminutive of the girl's name Bridget, and it is sometimes used as a disparaging slang term for women. Which is still the case. You call biddies as a slang term for, like, girls who play lacrosse and wear pearl earrings. That's what it was for me in college. Okay, so that remains a mystery. I did some more research about the definition of biddy in the dictionary and on the internet. A woman, especially an elderly one, regarded as annoying or interfering. Early 17th century, originally denoting a chicken. Of unknown origin, denoting an Irish maidservant. In Australia, a biddy is a two-for-one McDonald's voucher. Usually entitles the bear to enjoy two delicious Big Macs for the price of one. A biddy is one of those girls who wears short skirts and very high heels in very cold weather. So biddy could be a chicken, a girl named Bridget, or a woman. And as Paul Gillis, our intrepid road expert, told Angela,
High-low's biddy was the name of a very famous harness horse that was born in 1953, sired by Holyrood Hermes, which was a famous stud horse, and got a reputation as a trotter. So was the horse, you know, pastured there, or was it born there? I don't know.
A horse? I clearly had a lot of work to do. My next step was to see the High-Low Biddy Road for myself. So I drove to Putney, singing a song I made up along the way.
High-Low Biddy, 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 High-Low Biddy, Biddy, High-Low Biddy Road. High-Low Biddy, 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 High-Low Biddy.
There I met Michael, the question asker.
My name is Michael Hudson. We're in my home in Putney, Vermont. And my question is, who or what was the High-Low Biddy, and why did they name a road after he, she, or it? It doesn't make sense to me, you know? Like somebody said, oh, I know what we're going to call this road, the High-Low Biddy Road. And somebody else said, yeah, that's a good idea.
We walked out of his house, turned right, and within 100 yards, we were on High-Low Biddy. Here's the, this is the road?
This is it.
This is barely a road.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so there's a dead end sign. It's unpaved. It's gravelly. It's very overgrown.
Oh, yeah. There aren't many homes down here.
Yeah.
So right now we're going low, Biddy. We're walking downhill.
Well, I don't know. This might be high over here.
Whoever thought of it, I mean, it is very fun to say.
Oh, it is fun to say. It really is.
High, low, Biddy runs alongside a brook called Sackett's Brook. In the late 1700s and in the 1800s, this brook was the bustling home to many mills, manufacturing everything from flour to paper to flannel. Today, the ruins of these mills are still present.
Over there, you'll see, I think it's called the Twining's Mill. I guess this was the Owl Mills.
We got to the bottom of Biddy and crossed a bridge over Sackett's Brook.
It's too bad this is overgrown so much. This is the bridge, and it's a stone arch bridge. It's really cool. You know, it's one of those dry-laid stone bridges that are, I believe, held together by gravity.
It's called Sackett's Brook Stone Arch Bridge, and it was built by a stonemason named James Otis Follett in 1906. The stones are perfectly placed together, without any mortar holding them. Today, it's on the National Register of Historic Places. We continued down the road, where we met a High-Low Biddy resident. He didn't know the origin of High-Low Biddy, but he told us that his neighbor Tim was the person to talk to.
So, I know Tim is home. I'm sure he wouldn't mind if you knocked on his door. He knows a lot of the history here.
So we walked up to Tim's house. High-Low Biddy house, and there's horses on the sign!
That's right.
It's a clue.
You think so?
We knocked on the door. And we're told that Tim was in the shower.
Is he at the early end of the shower or the late end, does it seem like?
He's got about 5%.
When he got out of the shower, my hopes were high. First of all, what's your name?
Tim Regal.
And then?
Nobody really knows the answer as to why it was called High-Low Biddy. But it's one of those stories that's really lost in history. We don't know.
But he did have his own theory about the name.
And it's also an itty-bitty road. It's a very, very short road. That's all I can...
Drop the itty. That's all.
And as for the horse that I saw on his address sign, that was just a coincidence. Tim collects and restores horse-drawn carriages that he sells to museums. So I bid our question asker, Michael, farewell, and I went home to do some more research. I cracked open a digital copy of The History of Putney, Vermont by Edith DeWolf. The book was published in 1953, 66 years ago, and even back then, DeWolf wrote, "The origin of High-Low Biddy is not known." This book did resolve one thing, though. Remember that horse that Paul Gillis mentioned? Given the timing of this book's publication and the birth of the horse, I was able to conclude that the road was not named after the horse. So after I left town, High-Low Biddy became the historic question of the week in Putney, Vermont. The town Facebook group was alive with chatter about the road. I began calling the families who had lived on the road and anyone who might know something about the origin of the name. I talked to the Historical Society, the current town clerk, the previous town clerk, and the Vermont State Archives. And I kept getting the same answer.
To be honest with you, I don't know a lot.
I really don't remember anything about when it was named.
Okay. The closest I came to discovering the origin was talking to Jim Dunham, who grew up on the road. He claims that when he was in fifth grade, his teacher, Inez Harlow, told him the origin of the name, but that he forgot.
I wish I could remember. I really do wish I could remember. In one ear and out the other.
Most of the residents I spoke to said that they thought high-low came from the road starting high and dipping low. As for the Biddy, the majority believed that it was about the old women who lived on the road. Some thought that there was a Biddy at the high end and at the low end.
They would get together and make their dandelion wine and talk about the neighborhood.
That's Edna Turner, who used to live on the road. Whoever the Biddy was, her image remains strong in people's minds. The generation I spoke to clearly remembered the three older women that lived on High-Low Biddy when they were kids. Their names were Eva Turner, Elvira Rhodes, and Sarah Doyle. Here's Jim Dunham again, remembering Elvira.
She always gave us homemade donuts for Halloween. We always look forward to it.
Around 10 years ago, the town changed the road name to Thwing Road after a mill that was located on the brook. But the residents missed the name. They organized and petitioned to change it back to High-Low Biddy. The High-Low Biddy name was just too fun to say and too beloved by all.
Bianca Gaver. You've been listening to Brave Little States Road Name Histories right here on Vermont Edition. The stories you heard today were produced by Nina Keck, Bianca Gaver, Angela Evansy, and me, Lydia Brown. Brave Little State is edited by Lynn McRae. Our digital producer is Elodie Reed, and we have engineering support from Chris Albertine. Ty Gibbons composed our show's theme music, other music by Blue Dot Sessions, and the United States Old Guard Fife and Drum Corps. The archive audio in our Devil's Washbowl piece came from Monsters and Mysteries in America. Once again, this is Vermont Edition. I'm Lydia Brown. And I'm Angela Evansy. Thanks for listening.